The Secret Commonwealth of Elves, Fauns, and Fairies by Robert Kirk and Andrew Lang. An Adult Brain audiobook production, read by Graham Dunlop. Dedication to Robert Louis Stevenson.
O Louis, you like them maced, your far fray kelpie, wraith, and ghaist, and fairy dames no unco chaste, and haunted cell, among a heathen clan you're placed, that kens na hell. You hey nay heather, peat, nor birks, nay troot in your bunnies lurks. There are nay bonny, you pee kirks, an awful place. Nane kens the covenant o' works, fray that of grace. But whiles maybe to them ye'll read, blads of the covenanting creed, and whiles their pagan wames ye'll feed on hillsome parritch, and sink ye'll gar them learn a screed of the shorter carriage. Yet they uncovenanted shavers, hey routh, ye say, O clash and clavers, O gods and ettins and old wives' havers, but their delight, the voiced hymn that tells them quavers just with fair fright. And ye might tell a yaunt the fame, thy highland clashes o'er hame. To speak the truth, I talk na shame to have believed them, and stamped with Tusitala's name, they'll receive them. And folk to come a yaunt the sea may hear the yowl of the banshee, and fray the water kelpie flee, ere a thing's seas, and island bairns may stolen be by the folk o' peace. Faith, they might steal me, wi' my will, and kenny I only fairy hill. I'd lay me down there, snawed and still, their land to win, for man I've maistly had my fill of this world's din.
The Fairy Minister. In memory of the Reverend Robert Kirk, who went to his own herd and entered into the land of the people of peace in the year of grace 1692, and of his age 52.
People of peace, a peaceful man, well worthy of your love was he, who while the roaring Garry ran, red with the lifeblood of Dundee, while coats were turning, crowns were falling, wandered along his valley still, and heard your mystic voices calling from fairy knowe and haunted hill. He heard, he saw, he knew too well the secrets of your fairy clan. You stole him from the haunted dell, who never more was seen of man. Now far from heaven and safe from hell, unknown of earth, he wanders free. Would that he might return and tell of his mysterious company. For we have tired the folk of peace, no more they tax our corn and oil, their dances on the moorland seas, the brownie stints his wonted tale. No more shall any shepherd meet the ladies of the fairy clan, nor are their deathly kisses sweet on lips of any earthly man. And half I envy him who now, clothed in her court's enchanted green, by moonlit loch or mountain's brow, is chaplain to the fairy queen.
A. L. Kirk's Secret Commonwealth. Introduction. 1. The history of the book and author. The bibliography of the following little tract is extremely obscure. The title page of the edition of 1815, which we reproduce, gives the date as 1691. Sir Walter Scott says in his Demonology and Witchcraft, 1830, page 163, note, it was printed with the author's name in 1691 and reprinted in 1815 for Longman and Co. But was there really a printed edition of 1691? Scott says that he never met with an example. Research in our great libraries has discovered none, and there is none save that of 1815 at Abbotsford. The reprint of 100 copies was made, as it states, from no printed text, but from a manuscript copy preserved in the Advocate's Library. On page 45 of the edition of 1815, at the end of the comments on Lord Tarbut's letters, there is a note by the transcriber, that is, the person who wrote out the manuscript in the Advocate's Library. See the rest in a little manuscript belonging to Colin Kirk. Now, Colin, or Colin Kirk, writer to the signet, was the son of the Reverend Mr. Kirk, author of the tract. If the son had his father's book only in manuscript, it seems very probable that it was not printed in 1691, that the title page is only the title page of a manuscript. Till some printed text of 1691 is discovered, we may doubt, then, whether the 100 copies published in 1815, and now somewhat rare, be not the original printed edition. The editor has a copy of 1815, but it is the only one which he has met with for sale. The Reverend Robert Kirk, the author of The Secret Commonwealth, was a student of theology at St. Andrews. His master's degree, however, he took at Edinburgh. He was, and this is notable, the youngest and seventh son of Mr. James Kirk, minister of Aberfoyle, the place familiar to all readers of Rob Roy. As a seventh son, he was no doubt specially gifted, and in The Secret Commonwealth he lays some stress on the mystic privileges of such birth. There may be some secret virtue in the womb of the parent, which increaseth until the seventh son be born, and decreaseth by the same degree afterwards. It would not surprise us if Mr. Kirk no less than the Reverend Robert Blair of St. Andrews, 1650-60, could heal scrofula by the touch, like royal persons, Charles III, in Italy, for example. As is well known to all, the House of Brunswick has no such powers. However this may have been, Mr. Kirk was probably drawn by his seventh sonship to a more careful study of psychical phenomenon than most of his brethren bestowed. Little is known of his life. He was minister originally of Balquhidder, whence, in 1685, he was transferred to Aberfoyle. This was no covenanting district, and there is no bigotry in Mr. Kirk's dissertation. He was employed on an Irish translation of the Bible, and he published a Psalter in Gaelic, 1684. He married first Isobel, daughter of Sir Colin Campbell of Mulchester, who died in 1680, and secondly the daughter of Campbell of 40. This lady survived him. From his connection with Campbell's, we may misdoubt him for a Whig. By his first wife, he had a son, Colin Kirk, W.S. By his second wife, a son was minister of Dornoch. He died, if he did die, which is disputed, in 1692, aged about 51. His tomb was inscribed, Robertus Kirk, A.M., Linguae Hiberniae Lumen. The tomb in Scott's time was to be seen in the cast end of the churchyard of Aberfoyle, but the ashes of Mr. Kirk are not there. His successor, the Reverend Dr. Graham, in his Sketches of Picturesque Scenery, informs us that as Mr. Kirk was walking on a dunshee or fairy hill in his neighborhood, he sunk down in a swoon which was taken for death. After the ceremony of a seeming funeral, writes Scott, opposite page 105, the form of the Reverend Robert Kirk appeared to a relation and commanded him to go to Graham of Ducray. Say to Ducray, who is my cousin as well as your own, that I am not dead, but a captive in fairyland, and only one chance remains for my liberation, when the posthumous child, of which my wife has been delivered since my disappearance, shall be brought to baptism. I will appear in the room, when if Ducray shall throw over my head the knife or dirk which he holds in his hand, I may be restored to society. But if this is neglected, I am lost forever. True to his tryst, Mr. Kirk did appear at the christening, and was visibly seen. But Ducray was so astonished that he did not throw his dirk over the head of the appearance. And to society, Mr. Kirk has not yet been restored. This is extremely to be regretted, as he could now add matter of much importance to his treatise. Neither history nor tradition has more to tell about Mr. Robert Kirk, who seems to have been a man of good family, a student, and, as his book shows, an innocent and learned person. 2. The Secret Commonwealth. The tract of which the reader now knows the history is a little volume of somewhat singular character. Written in 1691 by the Reverend Robert Kirk, Minister of Aberfoyle, it is a kind of metaphysic of the fairy world. Having lived through the period of the sufferings of the Kirk, the author might have been expected either to neglect fairyland altogether, or to regard it as a mere appanage of Satan's kingdom. A burning question, indeed, for some of the witches who suffered at Presbyterian hands were merely narrators of popular tales about the state of the dead. That she trafficked with the dead and, from a ghost, won a medical recipe for the cure of Archbishop Adamson of St. Andrews was the charge against Alison Pearson.
The bishop kept his castle like a tod in his hall, sick of a disease of great fetidity, and oft-times under the cure of women suspected of witchcraft, namely Anna Wat confesseth hereto hath learned medicine of Annie, call it Mr. William Simpson, that appeared diverse times to hear after his dead, and gave her a buke. She was execute at Edinburgh for a witch.
James Melville's Diary, page 137, 1583. The archbishop, like other witches, had a familiar in the form of a hare, which once ran before him down the street. These were the beliefs of men of learning like James, the nephew and companion of Andrew Melville. Even in our author's own time, Archbishop Sharp was accused of entertaining the muckle black deal in his study at midnight and of being levitated and dancing in the air. This last feat, creditable to a saint or Neoplatonist like Plotinus, was reckoned for sin to Archbishop Sharp, as may be read in Woodrow's Analecta. Thus, all fairydom was commonly looked on as under the same guilt as witchcraft. Yet Mr. Kirk of Aberfoyle, living among Celtic people, treats the land of faery as a mere fact in nature, a world with its own laws, which he investigates without fear of the accuser of the brethren. We may thus regard him, even more than Woodrow, as an early student in folklore and in psychical research, topics which run into each other, and he shows nothing of the usual persecuting disposition. Nor again is Mr. Kirk like Glanville and Henry Moore. He does not, save in his title page and in one brief passage, make superstitious creeds or psychical phenomena into arguments and proofs against modern seducees. Firm in his belief, he treats his matter in a scientific spirit, as if he were dealing with generally recognized psychical phenomena. Our study of Mr. Kirk's little tractate must have a double aspect. It must be an essay partly on folklore, on popular beliefs, their relation to similar beliefs in other parts of the world, and the residuum of fact, preserved by tradition, which they may contain. On the other hand, as mental phenomena are in question, such things as premonitions, hallucinations, abnormal or unusual experiences generally, a criticism of Mr. Kirk must verge on psychical research. The society organized for that difficult subject certainly takes a vast deal of trouble about all manner of odd reports and strange visions. It transfers thoughts of no value at a great expense of time and of serious hard work. But as far as the writer has read the society's proceedings, it takes no keep, as Mallory says, of these affairs in their historical aspect. Whatever hallucination or illusion or imposture or the subliminal self can do today has always been done among peoples in every degree of civilization. An historical study of the topic, as contained in Trials for Witchcraft, in the reports of travelers and missionaries, In the works of the 17th century Platonists, Moore, Glanville, Sinclair, and others, and in the rare tracts such as The Devil in Glen Luce and The Just Devil of Woodstock, not to mention Levater, Wierus, Thyreus, Reginald Scott, and so on, is as necessary to the psychologist as to the folklorist. Note,
page 81, the Psychical Society, as far as the writer is aware, has not examined officially the old accounts of the phenomena which it investigates at present. The catalogue of the Society's library, however, proves that it does not lack the materials.
If there be an element of fact in modern hypnotic experiments, a matter of which I have really no opinion, it is plain that old magic and witchcraft are not mere illusions or not commonplace illusions. The subliminal self has his stroke in these affairs. Assuredly, the psychologist should have an historical department. The evidence which they would find is, of course, vitiated in many obvious ways. But the evidence contains much that coincides with that of modern times, and the coincidence can hardly be designed. That is to say, the old Highland seers had no design of abetting modern inquiry. It may be, however, that their methods and ideas have been traditionally handed down to modern sensitives and mediums. At all events, here is an historical chapter. If it be but a chapter in the history of human error, these wide and multifarious topics can only be touched on lightly in this essay. The author will be content if he directs his attention of students with more leisure and a better library of diablerie to the matter. But first we glance at the secret commonwealth as folklorists. 3. The subterranean inhabitants. Mr. Kirk's first chapter, Of the Subterranean Inhabitants, naturally suggests the recent speculations of Mr. MacRitchie. The gist of Mr. MacRitchie's testimony of tradition is that there once was a race of earth dwellers in this island, that their artificial caves still exist, that this people survive in popular memory as the legendary fiends, and as the Pects of popular tales, in which they are regarded as dwarves. The Pects were unco wee bodies, but terrible strang. Here, then, it might be thought that we have the origin of fairy beliefs. There really was on this showing a dwarf race who actually did live in the fairy hills or hoes, now commonly looked on as sepulchral monuments. There is much in Mr. MacRitchie's theory which does not commend itself to me. The modern legends of Pects as builders of Glasgow Cathedral, for example, do not appear to prove such a late survival of a race known as Pects, but are on a level with the old Greek belief that the Cyclopes built Mycenae. Testimony of Tradition, page 72. Granting, for the sake of discussion, that there were still Pects or Pecks in Galloway when Glasgow Cathedral was built in the 12th century, these wild Galloway men, scourges of the English border, were the very last people to be employed as masons. The truth is that the recent Scotch have entirely forgotten the ages of medieval art. Accustomed to the ill-built barns of a robbed and stinted kirk, they looked on the cathedral as no work of ordinary human beings. It was a creation of the Pects, as Mycenae and Tiryns of the mighty walls were creations of the Cyclopes. By another coincidence, the well-known story of the last Pect, who refuses to divulge the secret of the heather ale, is told in the Volsung saga and in the Nibelungenlied of the last Niflung. Again, the breaking of a bar of iron, which he takes for a human arm, by the last Pect is a tale current of the Dracos in modern Greece. See Chambers's Popular Traditions of Scotland for the last Pect. I cannot believe that the historical Picts were a set of half-naked dwarfish savages, hairy men living underground. These are the topics of Sir Arthur Wardour and Monkbarns, Mr. W.F. Skene, may be said to have put the historic picks in their proper place as the ancestors of the Highlanders. The Pect of legend answers to the Dracos and the Cyclopes. The beliefs about his habits may have been suggested by the Tumuli, still more by the Brocs. It seems less probable that they represent an historical memory. As to the Irish fiends, the topic can only be discussed by Celtic scholars. But it does not follow because the leader of the fiends seemed a dwarf among giants, that therefore his people were a dwarfish race. The story proves no more than Gulliver's Travels. Once more, we often read in the sagas of a hero like Grettir, who opens a how, has a conflict with a barrow wight, as Mr. Morris calls the how dweller, and wins gold and weapons. But the dweller in the how is often merely the able-bodied ghost of the Norseman, a known and named character who is buried there. He is not a pect. Thus, as it seems to me, the Scotch and Celts possessed a theory of a legendary people, as did the Greeks. Whether any actual traditions of an earlier, perhaps a Finnish race, was at the bottom of the legend is an obscure question. But having such a belief, the Scotch easily discovered homes for the fancied people in the sepulchral house. They combined their information. The fairies, again, are composite creatures. As they came to births and christenings, and as Norse wise wives, as in the saga of Eric the Red, prophesied at festivals, Mr. MacRitchie combines his own information. The wise wife is a Finn woman, and Finn and fairy amalgamate. But the Egyptians, as in the tale of two brothers, Maspero, Conte, Egyptienne, had their Hathors, who came and prophesied at births. The Greeks had their Morae, as in the story of Maligar and the Burning Brand. The Hathors and Morae play, in ancient Egypt and in ancient Greece, the part of fairies at the christening. But surely they were not Finnish women. In short, though a memory of some old race may have mingled in the composite fairy belief, this is at most but an element in the whole, and the part played by ancestral spirits, naturally earth dwellers, is probably more important. Bishop Calloway has pointed out in the preface to his Zulu Tales that what the Highlanders say of the fairies, the Zulus say of the ancestors. In many ways, as when persons carried off to fairyland meet relations or friends lately deceased, who warn them, as Persephone and Steenie Steenson were warned, to eat no food in this place, fairyland is clearly a memory of the pre-Christian Hades. There are other elements in the complex mass of fairy tradition, but Chaucer knew the fairy queen Proserpina, as Campion calls her, and it is plain that in very fact, the dread Persephone, the queen over death and the dead, had dwindled into the lady who borrows Tamlane in the ballad. Indeed, Kirk mentions but does not approve of this explanation, that those subterranean people are departed souls. Now, as was said, the dead are dwellers under earth, the worshippers of Cluthonian Demeter, Achaea, beat the earth with wands. So does the Zulu sorcerer when he appeals to the ancestors. And a MacDonald in Moidart, being pressed for his rent, beat the earth and cried aloud to his dead chief, Simon, hear me. You were always good to me. 4. Fairyland and Hades. Thus, to my mind at least, the subterranean inhabitants of Mr. Kirk's book are not so much a traditional recollection of a real dwarfish race living underground, a hypothesis of Sir Walter Scott's, as a lingering memory of the Cluthonian beings, the ancestors. A good case in point is that of Bessie Dunlop of Dowry in Ayrshire, tried on 8 November 1576 for witchcraft. She dealt in medicine and white magic and obtained her prescriptions from Thomas Reed, slain at Pinky Fight, 1547, who often appeared to her and tried to lead her off to fairyland. She, like Allison Pearson, was convict and burnt. Scott's Demonology, page 146, and Pitcairn's Criminal Trials. Both ladies knew the Fairy Queen, and Allison Pearson beheld Maitland of Lethington and Buccleuch in Fairyland, as is recounted in a rhymed satire on Archbishop Adamson Dalzell's Scottish Poems, page 321. These are excellent proofs that Fairyland was a kind of Hades or home of the dead. Mr. Kirk, who speaks of the Shlema as confidently as if he were discussing the habits of some remote race which he had visited, credits them as the Greek gods were credited, with the power of nourishing themselves on some fine essential part of human sacrifice, of human food, some fine spirituous liquors that pierce like pure air and oil on the poison or substance of corns and liquors. Others, more gross, steal the actual grain, as do crows and mice. They are heard hammering in the house. As brownies, they enter houses and cleanse the hearths. They are the domovoys, as the Russians call them. John Major, in his exposition of St. Matthew, 1518, fall 48, gives perhaps the oldest account of brownies in a believing temper. Major styles them fauni, or brobne. They thrash as much grain in one night as 20 men could do. They throw stones about among people sitting by the fire. Whether they can predict future events is doubtful. See Mr. Constable and Major's Greater Britain, page 30, Edinburgh, 1892. To us they seem not much remote from the Roman Lares, spirits of the household, of the hearth. In all these creatures, Mr. Kirk recognizes an abstruse people, who were before our more substantial race, whose furrows are still to be seen on the hilltops. They never were, to his mind, plain, palpable folk. They are only visible in their quarterly flittings to men of the second sight. That gift of vision includes not only power to see distant or future events, but the viewless forms of air. To shun the flittings, men visit church on the first Sunday of the quarter. Then they will be hallowed against elf shots, these arrows that fly in the dark. As is well known, superstition explained the Neolithic arrowheads as fairy weapons. It does not follow that a tradition of a Neolithic people suggested the belief in fairies. But we cannot deny absolutely that some such memory of an earlier race, a shy and fugitive people who used weapons of stone, may conceivably play its part in the fairy legend. Thence Mr. Kirk glides into that singular theory of savage metaphysics which somewhat resembles the Platonic doctrine of ideas. All things in Red Indian belief have somewhere their ideal counterpart or father. Thus a donkey, when first seen, was regarded as the father or archetype of rabbits. Now the second sighted behold the double man, doppelganger, astral body, wraith, or what you will, of a living person, and that is merely his counterpart in the abstruse world. The industry of the psychical society has collected much material evidence, whatever its value, for the existence of the double man. We may call it a hallucination, which does not greatly increase our knowledge. From personal experience and the experience of friends, I am constrained to believe that we may think we see a person who is not really present to the view, who may be in the next room or downstairs or 100 miles off. This experience has occurred to the same, the unimaginative, the healthy, the free from superstition, and in circumstances by no means mystic. For example, when the person supposed to be seen was not dying, nor distressed, nor in any but the most normal condition. Indeed, the cases when there was nothing abnormal in the state of the person seen are far more numerous in my personal knowledge than those in which the person seen was dying or dead or excited. The reverse appears to be the rule in the experience of the psychical society.
The actual proportion of coincidental to non-coincidental cases, after all deduction for possible sources of error, was in fact such that the probability against the supposition of chance coincidence became enormous, on the assumption of ordinary accuracy on the part of informants.
Professor Sidgwick, Proc SPR, Volume 8, page 607. Some 17,000 answers were collected. We must apparently accept these facts as not very abnormal nor very unusual, and doubtless as capable of some subjective explanation. But when such things occurred among imaginative and uneducated Highlanders, they became foundations and proofs of the doctrine of second sight. Proofs, too, of the primitive metaphysical doctrine of counterparts and correspondences. They avouch that every element and different state of being have animals resembling these of another element. By persons not knowing this, the Roman invention of guardian angels, particularly assigned, has been promulgated. The guardian angel of the Roman superstition is merely the double or co-walker, the type, in the viewless world, of the man in the apparent world. Thus are wraiths and ghosts explained by our Presbyterian psychologist and his Highland flock. All things universally have their types. Their reflex, a man's type or reflex or co-walker, may be seen at a distance from or near him during his life. Nay, may be seen after his death. The gifted man of second sight can tell the substantial figure from the airy counterpart. Sometimes the reflex anticipates the action of the reality. Was often seen of old to enter a house by which the people knew that the person of that likeness was to visit them in a few days. It may have occurred to most of us to meet a person in the street whom we took for an acquaintance. It is not he, but we meet the real man a few paces further on. Thus, a distinguished officer at home on leave met a friend, as he tells me, in Piccadilly. The other passed without notice. The officer hesitated about following him, did not, and in some 50 yards met this man. There is probably no more in this than resemblance and coincidence, but this is the kind of thing which was worked by the Highlanders into their metaphysics. Note,
a much odder case is reported. Two young men photographed the reach of a river. In the photograph, when printed, was visible the dead body of a woman floating down on the stream. The water was dragged, nothing was found, but 2 or 3 days later, a girl drowned herself in the pool. As the reports of the Psychical Society sometimes say, no confirmation has been obtained. But this is a pleasing instance of the reflex and of second sight in a photographic camera.
The end of the co-walker is obscure. This copy, echo, or living picture goes at last to his own herd. Thus, ghosts are short-lived, and according to Monsieur Dacier, on the manners of posthumous man, l'homme posthume, seldom survive for more than a century. By an airy being of this kind, the Highlanders explain the false or morbid appetite. A joint eater inhabited the patient. He feeds, too, when he eats. As a rule, the fairies get their food as witches do, take the pith and milk from their neighbor's cows unto their own chesold, throw a hair tether at a great distance by airt magic, only drawing a spigot fastened in a post which will bring milk as far as a bull will be heard to roar. This is illustrated in the drinking scene in Faust. This kind of charge is familiar in trials for witchcraft. In accordance with the whole metaphysics of the system of doubles, which are parasites on humanity, is the superstition of nurses stolen by fairies, and of children kidnapped while changelings are left in their place. The latter accounts for a sudden decline and loss of health by a child. He is not the original child, but a fairy brat. To guard against this bread as human food hateful to fairies, so the Kanakas carry a boiled yam about at night or the Bible, or iron is placed in the bed of childbirth. Iron scares spirits, as the scholiast says, of the drawn sword of Odysseus in Hades. The fairy bride in Wales vanishes on being touched with iron. This belief probably came in when iron was a new, rare, and mysterious metal. The mortal nurses in Fairyland are pleasantly illustrated by the ballad.
I heard a cow lows, a bony, bony cow low.
In C. Kirkpatrick Sharp's ballad book, this part of the superstition is not easy to elucidate. Kirk repeats the well-known tales of the blinding of the mortal who saw too clearly by making use of their ointments. Well-known examples occur in Gervais of Tilbury and are cited in Scott's note on Tamlane in the Border Minstrelsy. As Homer fables of the dead, their speech is a kind of whistling like the cry of bats, another indication of the pre-Christian Hades. Note,
page 81, that the voice of spirits is a kind of whistling, twittering, or chirping is a very widely diffused and ancient belief. The ghosts in Homer twitter like bats. In New Caledonia, an English settler found that he could scare the natives from a piece of ground by whistling there at night. Mr. Samuel Wesley says, I followed the noise into almost every room in the house, both by day and by night, with lights and without, and have sat alone for some time. And when I heard the noise, spoke to it to tell me what it was, but never heard any articulate voice. And only once or twice, two or three feeble squeaks, a little louder than the chirping of a bird, and not like the noise of rats, which I have often heard. Memoirs of the Wesley Family, page 164. Professor Alexander mentions the peculiar whistling sound at some manifestations in Rio Janeiro as rather frequent. Proc. S.P.R. 81-19-180. Here, children were the mediums. How did they get the idea of the traditional whistle?
They have feasts and burials, and Pashley, in his travels in Crete, tells the well-known border story of a man who fired on a fairy bridal and heard a voice cry, "Ye have slain the bonny bridegroom." It is, of course, to be noted that the modern Greek superstition of the Nereids, who carry off mortal girls to dance with them till they pine away, answers to some of our fairy legends, while it will hardly be maintained that the Nereids are a memory of prehistoric Finns. Antic Corybantic Jollity is a note of Nereids, as well as of the Schlema. The inconvenience of their succubi, the fairy girls who make love to young men, is well known in the Breton ballad Le Sieur Nan. The same superstition is current among the Kanakas of New Caledonia. My cousin, Mr. Atkinson, was visited by a young Kanaka, who twice or thrice returned to take leave of him with much emotion. When Mr. Atkinson asked what was the matter, the lad said that he had just met, as he thought, the girl of his heart in the forest. After a scene of dalliance, she vanished, and he knew that she was a forest fairy, and that he must die in 3 days, which he did. This is the inconvenience of their succubi, regretted by Mr. Kirk. Thus, it appears that the mass of these opinions is not local nor Celtic merely, but of worldwide diffusion. Thus, Sir Walter Scott observes of the Afghans and Highlanders, their superstitions are the same or nearly so. The Goli Babakan, demons of the desert, resemble the Bodok of the Highlanders, who walked the heath at midnight and at noon. Quarterly Review, 14-289. Again, Mr. Kirk says that werewolves and witches, true bodies are, by the union of the spirit of nature that runs through all, echoing and doubling the blow towards another, wounded at home, when the astral or assumed bodies are stricken elsewhere. Thus, if a witch hare is shot, the witch's real body is hurt in the same part. And Laffitau, in North America, found that when a Huron shot a witch bird, the real magician was stricken in the same place. The theory that the fairies appear as a little rough dog is illustrated by the Welsh dogs of hell. Blackwood's magazine for 1818 contains many examples of these hell dogs, which are often invested in a sheet of fire, as Rink says is the case among the Eskimo. Take a modern instance. Mr. F.A. Paley and friend, walking home at night on a lonely road, see a large black dog rise from it, slowly walk to the side and disappear. They search in vain. Mr. Paley hears subsequently that the mysterious dog is the terror of the neighborhood, but no such real dog is known. Date, summer, 1837, Journal of S.P.R., Feb. 1893, page 31. The dwellings of these airy shadows of mankind are naturally fairy hills. There is such a hill, the Fairy Hill at Aberfoyle, where Mr. Kirk resided. Bailey Nicol Jarvie describes its legends in an admirable passage in Rob Roy. Mr. McRitchie says, "How much of this how is artificial, or whether any of it is, remains to be discovered. It is much larger than most artificial tumuli. According to Mr. Kirk, the Highlanders superstitiously believe the souls of their predecessors to dwell in the fairy hills. And for that end, say they, a moat or mount was dedicated beside every churchyard to receive the souls till their adjacent bodies arise and so become as a fairy hill." Here the Highland philosophers have conspicuously put the cart before the horse. The tumuli are much older than the churches, which were no doubt built beside them because the place had a sacred character. Two very good examples may be seen at Dalry on the Ken in Galloway and at Parton on Loch Ken. The grassy howes are large and symmetrical, and the modern Presbyterian churches occupy old sites. At Parton, there are ruins of the ancient Catholic church. Round the tumulus at Dalry, according to the local form of the Marchan of Hesion, a great dragon used to coil in triple folds before it was killed by the blacksmith. Nobody, perhaps, can regard these tumuli, and many like them, as anything but sepulchral. On the road between Ballantrae in Ayrshire and Stranraer, there is a beautiful tumulus above the sea, which at once recalls the barrow above the main at Elpenor in the Odyssey. Asked Odysseus to build for him the memorial of a luckless man. In the Argonautica of Apollonius Rhodius, the ghost of a hero who fell at Troy appears to the adventurers on a tumulus like this of the Ayrshire coast. And speaking of these barrows, Mr. Kirk tells how, during a famine about 1676, two women had a vision of a treasure hid in a fairy hill. This they excavated and discovered some coins of good money. The great gold corselet of the British Museum is said to have been found in Wales, where tradition spoke of a ghost in golden armor which haunted a hillock. The hillock was excavated, and the golden corselet, like the Shakespearean bricks, is alive to testify to the truth of the story. Thank you for listening to this sample. To continue listening to this book and for access to all of our other full audiobooks, please subscribe for $7.77 per month. Go to adultbrain.ca or follow the link in the show notes. This will be a completely separate podcast with a new RSS feed and will have all the titles from this feed as well. Thank you for your help and support in bringing rare and forgotten books to audio for the world.